All right, welcome to Theology on Tap. So, hopefully you have gotten some beer or soda, gotten some food. So, it's been a little while since our last Theology on Tap because of Thanksgiving, but again, this is something sponsored by the Cathedral Parish here in downtown Madison. My name is Mark Ligonio, do some young adult ministry there, so thanks for coming out to celebrate St. Nicholas Day. Also, the 24th birthday of Giannis Antetokounmpo, if any of you care about that.
Yeah.
That's right. All right, go Bucks. All right, so thanks for being here. Tonight, we really have a special event. We have my good friend, Father Scott Jablonski, my boss and also good friend, Monsignor Holmes, who will be talking about their journey to the Holy Land. So they went to the Holy Land during Lent this past spring, and got to see all these different places that we read about in the Bible. So they're going to share their experience of walking the places where God walked. This is quite a claim that we make in the Christian faith, that it's not just about an idea, it's not just about a philosophy, but the very fact that God chose a particular place, a particular time, a particular body to live in, so that he could experience our life and change it from within. And they had a very particularly close experience of that, being able to go on pilgrimage to the Holy Land. So let's give them a hand for being with us tonight.
I was telling Monsignor Holmes just a few minutes ago that this is the largest crowd I've ever had gathered to learn about my vacations before. So I really appreciate all of you wanting to see everything that I did and all the foods I ate. But no, truly, thank you for being here tonight. It's really a great privilege to be able to share this with all of you. So right after we got back from the Holy Land, I thought, well, I should put some pictures together. My grandparents are going to want to see them. And so I put together this like 5.5 hour long presentation. We're going to try to shorten it just a little bit for all of you, as I think many of you want to get home before midnight. But Monsignor sent me an email the other day, and he said, well, Father Scott, you're really good with people, so you kind of show a couple pictures of people, and then I'm going to get into the serious stuff. So when we took off, now this thing's broken. Hang on one second here.
Told you, you should let me do that.
Okay, so we ended up going last February with the Knights and Ladies of the Holy Sepulchre, which is a group that is all across, is it just the United States or the entire world? It's worldwide. And what they do is they try to support Christians in the Holy Land. And so this is our group here. And as you can see, I'm right there. There's this other young woman here. And then my friend from seminary who's also young. And then everyone else is about 30 years older than us. So lots of bathroom breaks, lots of stopping, like, you know, rub your feet, lots of stretching, things of that nature. So it was a little bit of a sacrifice. It really was a pilgrimage, at least for me, for him, it was a vacation. So, all right, Monsignor, I think you're up.
All right, so this is a little orientation about where things are in relation to each other. First, a map of the whole Holy Land. You know, in the news, when you hear about the West Bank, that refers to the West Bank of the Jordan River, which is here. Before 1967, this was Jordan over here. Actually, this is Jordan here, too. But well, this is the West Bank. This is the East Bank. So this is Israel occupies. But there are two basic areas that are of great interest. That little blue spot there is the Sea of Galilee. And that region up there is Galilee, where Nazareth, the Lord's hometown, was, where he spent most of his public life. Down here is Jerusalem, and this is the area called Judea. And the Lord would visit Jerusalem for the holy days. He was born outside Jerusalem. in Bethlehem. He was baptized by John the Baptist at the Jordan River down in the area of Judea. The Blessed Mother came to visit her cousin Elizabeth down in the Judean hills. So there are a number of places of interest here in the Lord's earlier life, the beginning of his public life, and then the end of his life. But the majority of his ministry was up here in Galilee. So this is a closer look at the northern... one more? Gotcha. One more close-up of Galilee. So here... Oh, that was wrong. So here is Nazareth, the Lord's hometown. You might remember that in one of the Gospels, someone is told that they've met Jesus, he's from Nazareth. The comment is, can any good come from Nazareth? That's because Nazareth is up in the hills of Galilee, a really insignificant podunk town. Likewise, Cana, where the Lord performed his first miracle, close to Nazareth, also a very unimportant town in the hills. So when the Blessed Mother asked Jesus to help the couple at their wedding who had run out of wine, when he says, my time has not yet come, it's not just a matter of not being quite ready to perform a miracle yet. It's that this isn't where he wants to perform a miracle, up here in Nowheresville. The Lord spent most of his public life down here around the city of Capernaum. I must say, before this pilgrimage, I had certainly heard the name Capernaum in the Gospels many times, but I did not really appreciate how important that town of Capernaum was. It was really the Lord's home base for his whole public life in Galilee. And it was at a sort of crossroads, north-south and east-west, trade routes, so that Capernaum was a significant place where many people would hear what Jesus had to say, and knowledge of him would begin to spread by people who were traveling through and would tell others that they met along the way. So Capernaum was very, very interesting. And then along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, other events in the Lord's public life took place. We'll look at some of them. Down here is Mount Tabor, where the Transfiguration took place. But all those things are there in the region of Galilee. Over on the coast, we have... I have to be able to close enough to see it.
It's the last one at the bottom.
Caesarea. Caesarea Maritima. I don't think the Lord ever went there, but that's where Pontius Pilate lived most of the time. Beautiful Roman city built on the Mediterranean, where the Roman trading ships would come in. We're just going to look at a couple of, one slide of Caesarea for the sake of comparison in a few minutes. So down in the south is Judea. Jerusalem, of course, the capital. The Jordan River and Bethany across the Jordan, where John was baptized. Right after the baptism, Jesus is driven into the desert and is tempted. This is the hill country where tradition says that those temptations took place. Here is Jericho, where the Lord encountered Zacchaeus. Jericho is the oldest continuously inhabited place in the whole world or the Western world?
The whole world.
The whole world. Like since about
9,000
BC. For 11,000 years, Jericho has been inhabited. This is another Bethany where Mary, Martha, and Lazarus lived. Here is Bethlehem, where the Lord was born, very close by Jerusalem. And in the hill country of Judea here was also the the home of Zechariah and Elizabeth, where the visitation took place.
So this is just a quick map of Jerusalem as well, the Old City. And the interesting thing is the Old City is rather small, but it's divided into four quarters these days. So down over here, we have the Christian quarter, kind of this part right here. And then up here is the Muslim quarter. Down here, we have the Armenian quarter. And then up here is the Jewish quarter. And so the Old City of Jerusalem is divided into four. And so the different kind of religious groups kind of control the four parts of the city. It was interesting. We walked around and everything. I walked through the Muslim quarter. I walked through the Armenian quarter. People were very friendly. They were very helpful. They gave us directions. It's a lot like Wisconsin. Nice people. But it's just something to kind of be aware of. I'm not going to get too much more into the map just for the sake of brevity. We're going to keep going here. So, Monsignor, you're up again. So this is, we're going up to Nazareth now. So we're kind of up near the region of Galilee, near the Sea of Galilee here.
I'll take care of this.
Okay. So this is the Church of the Annunciation. I had seen photographs of this through the years, different angles, different views of it. And, you know, you look at this church and you think, well, yes, 20th century church, the Church of the Annunciation. Yeah, all right, you know, okay, the Annunciation took place in Nazareth, I believe that. So someplace within the general vicinity of this church, probably that's where the Blessed Mother received that message. Much to my surprise, that we really know much more about the Annunciation and where it took place than I thought we did. Because that was the 20th century church. But that church was built on the ruins of a Crusader church built around the year 1100 when the Crusaders went to the Holy Land to take back the holy places from the Muslims. The Crusader church was built on the ruins of a Byzantine church when St. Helena, the mother of Constantine, came to the Holy Land in search of the true cross. She toured all the holy places and inaugurated the building of a number of churches where the local Christians told her that these events had taken place. So she was there in the 4th century when the memory of the local Christians said, this is where the Annunciation took place. Church was built there. Replaced by a Crusader church in the 11th century, replaced by a 20th century church, but the place has been attested for many, many centuries. So here you see the foundations of the Crusader church, and then through the archway at the end, the cave where the Annunciation was said to have taken place by those Christians who pointed out to St. Helena. And on the altar there, in front of the altar, it says, verbum caro hic factum est. So verbum caro factum est is a famous Christian saying, the word was made flesh. Adding hic is the Latin word here. So here, the word was made flesh. That's the spot that's been revered as the place of the Annunciation, where the Lord began to live in the womb of his Blessed Mother for many, many centuries. And so here's the upper church. This was built in the 20th century, but it enshrines those earlier spots.
And that's kind of one of the interesting things, once again, over and over again, the story of the Holy Land is, there's a sacred site where something happened. The early Christians would venerate that site. Then eventually, once Christianity became legal, they would build a church upon there. Then eventually, that church got knocked down. Then eventually, the Christians would take control of the area again. They would rebuild a new church upon the remains of that. That church would get knocked down, and then eventually, they'd build a new one. So it's just a series of, like, buildings, destruction, building, destruction. So a lot of these churches, you're going to see layer after layer after layer. But as Monsignor rightly noted, the really interesting thing is, you know, it goes back, like, the ruins actually testify to the fact that these places have been venerated, going all the way back to the time of Jesus and the apostles. So moving on here, right next to the Church of the Annunciation in Nazareth is the Church of St. Joseph. And just kind of a great little mosaic here of the Holy Family, especially during the season of Advent as we're preparing for Christmas. But once again, you can kind of see it was a little bit of a cave. And what this shows is that Mary and Joseph, they would have lived in caves, not being wealthy. You know, sometimes we kind of think, well, what kind of houses would they have lived in? But really, they were living in caves. It was just like anything you would find was some sort of shelter and covering and things of that. So this was kind of St. Joseph's little house slash workshop area, and it's immediately adjacent to the church, that large Church of the Annunciation that we just saw. So this is Monsignor's next favorite part. He's a water guy, so he really likes the ocean.
Well, of course, this is ruins, but this is the southern end of this beautiful Roman town, Caesarea Maritima, and this is where Pontius Pilate's palace was. So the contrast between this beautiful water views that Pilate had and these built-out caves where the Blessed Mother was living in Nazareth, the whole theme of, you know, the Lord has chosen the lowly to overthrow the great, that's very, very clear and not at all theoretical. When you see the power of the Roman Empire, the ruins of the beautiful structures that the Romans built, and the humility and poverty of the town of Nazareth.
So then moving on, just right outside outside of Jerusalem, is Ein Kerem, which is where the Church of the Visitation is. And so this is where once Mary finds out because of the angel Gabriel that she is expecting, she goes and she travels in haste to visit her cousin Elizabeth. And the thing that's very interesting is, first of all, this is kind of up on a hill, so it was a kind of a very long walk. And once again, there were three of us in the group that were able to do that walk a little bit more quickly. And then the rest had to call a cab to bring them up. I'm just kidding. They didn't actually do that. But it was kind of at the top of this hill. What is very beautiful is this image right here that is kind of on the front of the church. And it's Mary riding kind of on donkey or horseback or something like that, but being surrounded by angels. And the idea is the artist took a liberty thinking, you know, here's Mary, pregnant with Jesus, the God of the universe, a young Jewish girl, 13, 14, 15 years old, having to travel all the way from Nazareth in the north down to the south outside of Jerusalem to visit her cousin Elizabeth. How is God going to protect her? I mean, you know, the world is no different back then than it is today. I mean, just violent people would be willing to kind of take advantage of a young woman. And so this artist kind of took the liberty of thinking, of course, God is going to send his angels to accompany Mary on this very important journey to go visit Elizabeth, which, once again, it's not scriptural per se, but it's a beautiful image of God just kind of taking care of the woman who, because of her fiat, allowed his son to come into the world. So this is just very quickly inside of the church, kind of the upper level of the church, and then down in the lower level is this well. And the tradition holds that that is the well where Mary met Elizabeth and first encountered her, and John the Baptist would have left in Elizabeth's womb, and this first encounter between these cousins, between these pregnant women together. Okay, so moving on now to Bethlehem and the Church of the Nativity.
So, of course, Bethlehem is very important to Christians, being the birthplace of the Lord. So that has always been a very, very Christian area. We visited Bethlehem University, a Christian-founded university. Pope Paul VI encouraged its founding when he visited the Holy Land in the 1960s. We visited a hospital for children run by Catholics in Bethlehem. Also the seminary for the Latin diocese or patriarchate that covers five countries in the Holy Land: Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Cyprus, I think. And we had dinner with the seminarians there. So Bethlehem is quite a Christian area. The Orthodox actually have the site of the Nativity in a church that they own, the Church of the Nativity. So you see there kind of typical Orthodox decorations of the iconostasis and the lamps. And then down again in a cave-like area under that main church is the place where tradition says the Lord was born, marked by that silver star on the ground.
It's really interesting. Typically, if you're trying to get down, so once again, underneath this area, is kind of in the basement, so to speak, that's where this is, and this is the area that marks where the Lord Jesus was born. And typically, you get down there, it's a couple hour wait, but our tour guide was fantastic. We really lucked out. Super knowledgeable, a faithful Catholic who had grown up in the old city of Jerusalem. But he also knew the timing through and through. So he got us at these places exactly when you want to get there. And I think maybe, we waited like maybe 12 minutes or something like that. And then we were able to go down there. And you see this 14-point star, and the 14 points is symbolic of the 14 generations that we hear about in the genealogies, 14 generations from the time of Adam to Abraham, I believe, and then Abraham to, is it David, and then David to Christ. So it's symbolic of that. It was really wonderful, though, when we were down there, normally they rush you through. It's kind of like, it's like anything where they're trying to kind of just get people through as fast as possible. But this was one of the happy times where it was really nice to be with some elderly people, because we're down there. I mean that wholeheartedly. We were down there, and while we were down there, normally, like I said, they rush you through, but they were in the middle of changing some of the oil candles. And as they're doing that, one of the elderly couples in our group, they didn't realize they were doing this, and so they backed up, and they knocked over one of the oil candles, and so oil was all over the ground. And so next thing you know, they said, nobody's allowed to move because they didn't want to have the oil tracked all over. I mean, it would have been a mess. So we actually got stuck down there for like 10 extra minutes. And our whole group, so like more or less, we're just down there, and we had the opportunity to be right there. And then there's an area right behind there where the Lord's manger is said to have been. And so it's just a great opportunity to have extra prayer time. As we say in our Catholic tradition, oh, happy fault, right? So happy fault that they knocked over the oil candle. And then it's really interesting because, once again, this is the Greek part of the church. And so within this building, there are different groups who kind of control different parts. The Greek part is owned by right there, right above the place where the Lord was born. And then right next to it is the Latin part. So this is where we actually celebrated Mass. And it's a little less historically significant, but this is where, as Latin Rite Catholics, we were able to celebrate Mass in the Church of the Nativity here. Are you doing this one or am I? Okay, I'm doing this one. So then right outside Bethlehem is the Shepherd's Field. And this is the place where, as the angels come to the shepherds who are tending their flocks and say, you know, behold, a great king has been born this night, and the shepherds rejoice at this great news of the gospel, the great news that Christ has been born into the world. So this is the church that is there. And then inside the church, kind of in the lower level, this is the actual cave. And this was very fascinating to me. I didn't grow up on a farm. I milked a cow for the first time like 3 years ago, and it was a disaster. I just know nothing about this kind of lifestyle. But back then in the ancient world, the shepherds would actually take their flocks into the caves, and they would all kind of like live there at night together. And so in this cave is where they say the shepherds would have been with their flocks to kind of protect them at night. And then they built this church over the top, but you can go in there, and obviously you can have Mass down there as well. Which is really, really pretty wonderful. Okay, so this is pretty exciting too.
So we went into Jordan, country to the east of Israel, and down to the ancient city of Petra, which became famous by being in Indiana Jones film, and extremely impressive. Great valleys to the rocks that you walk through for some distance, and then you come to this place where there are these great structures just excavated from the soft red stone that is there. And so interesting. Again, historically, the people lived in caves in this area. The structures such as this were tombs to their ancestors. So, you know, in our civilization, we have, you know, great estates with marble bathrooms for ourselves, and you know, can't spare an hour for a funeral for somebody who has passed away. For them, they lived in caves, but those who had gone before them had these monuments. So very interesting distinction. But the biblical connection for Petra is that it was on a great trade route from the east. And so the magi, the astrologers, the wise men who came to visit the Lord's cradle, very likely stopped in Petra, because everybody stopped in Petra if you're coming from Arabia, coming from the east to the Holy Land.
One of the kind of interesting thing is when we were there, we actually walked into a couple of the caves, and people were living in these caves until the 1980s. A lot of the guides who were, you could ride like a horse through, once again, these tunnels, and they would have like kind of a guide walking you along with that horse. And a lot of these people, they were probably in their 50s or 60s now, but they would have grown up in these caves. So we had the chance to actually go in them. And you could tell that people had lived in these caves for about 2,000 years because they smelled like people had lived in these caves for 2,000 years. So they didn't have those Yankee candles there to kind of make it smell nice and everything. So and this is the Jordan River, the site of the Lord's baptism, and this is yours.
So as you might know, rivers occasionally change course because the way that the flow of water hits the shoreline, eventually it erodes the dirt that's there and it cuts a new channel. So this is the place, the east bank of the Jordan River, where a little spring called St. John's Spring comes into what had been the main channel of the Jordan River. So this is no longer the main channel of the Jordan River, but this is where it's thought that the baptism of the Lord took place 2,000 years ago. And there are a number of churches not far from this site on the east bank of the Jordan River. That's the site of the Lord's baptism. Now, that little mud hole there is the current Jordan River, which is very unimpressive down that far south, because, of course, water is so precious in the Holy Land that everyone is taking water from the Jordan River as it flows north to south. And by the time it gets that close to the Dead Sea, there's not much flowage left. So it's very muddy, very unimpressive as a river. You can see in the middle of the water there a little marker for the division between the State of Israel and the nation of Jordan. And in the river, at this site that's kind of promoted as the Lord's baptism site on the from the east side, which we think really wasn't because the river has changed its course and it was really over on the other side. But this is where many of the tourists come, and there were some, I'm sure there were very nice Russians who had more than enough borscht and were a little pasty, wearing their Speedos, cavorting in the Jordan River there, trying to have that authentic baptismal experience.
Part of the reason, too, though, is in order to get over to the actual authentic baptismal site that we were at, as well as Petra, we actually once again had to cross over from Israel into the country of Jordan. And it's a little bit of a process. It was very funny when we were at the border, though. You're never quite sure what to expect and everything. And so we go in, we're on this bus, we all have to get off, we take all our luggage off, and then we had to go in to passport control. And I was the first one, so I went in there, and they did like an eye scan, which I was like kind of freaked out by. I was just like, you know, what is this? Like some sort of like weird sci-fi movie or something like that. But I went through right away. And so I'm kind of waiting for the rest of the group, and there was like this little stand that had like maps, and I thought, well, it'd be nice to get a map of Jordan. So I'm kind of looking, but all the English maps are taken, and so they have all maps in other languages. And all of a sudden, right next to this map stand is this office door, and it's kind of somewhat open, and the guy sees me, and he opens the door the rest of the way, and he's like, come, come. And I'm like, I'm going to die. I don't know what's going on. So I walk in, and there's two guys there, and the one guy who invited me in, he's probably 75, 80 years old, and the other guy is probably in his like late 50s. And the whole room is just filled with cigarette smoke, and the 80-year-old is just like... I'm like, well, this is very uncomfortable. And he points for me to sit down, and the other guy is drinking coffee, and he's also smoking. And they're like, do you want some coffee? And I said, well, okay. And the guy who was smoking and drinking coffee is like, here's my cup. I was like, well, actually, I'm okay. I don't want to get lung cancer from this cup of coffee. But anyway, they said, what can we help you with? I said, well, I'd like to have a map in English. And they said, so he goes over to this cabinet and very slowly opens it up, even more slowly takes out this bag, even more slowly walks to his desk, goes back to the cabinet, grabs another bag, back to his desk. I'm like, he's going to pull out a knife and like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just, a worst case scenario, right? Instead, he first pulls out some candies and he's like, candy. I was like, oh, okay, I'll have candy. So I had a candy and I'm sitting there eating candy, and then he like, he has to cut off the saran wrap off the map. So he finally gives me this English map, and he's like the most friendly guy in the entire world. Next thing you know, all these other people in our group see me, and I'm like, you know, smoking and drinking coffee. Not smoking, but you know, I'm like, you know these people, right? And so next thing we have like three or four guys in there, or three or four people, and we're all like, you know, looking at maps and eating candy together. And they're the most friendly people in the entire world. So really, if you're ever in Jordan, say hi to my friend, the cigarette-smoking guy. So, okay, so outside Jericho then, once again, this is kind of towards the south, and this is the site of the Lord's baptism. As Monsignor said, Jericho is the longest continually inhabited city. They've done excavations and they've uncovered about 20 different settlements, 20 layers of civilization, and somewhere between like 9 and 11,000 years continuously, people have been living in the city of Jericho. But up in these mountains up here, this is kind of where they say that the Lord would have been led you know, for his temptations in the desert and everything. And so it just gives you a very quick visual of what that kind of would have looked like. Okay, so here's the Sea of Galilee now.
So after the Lord was baptized, not far outside Jerusalem by the Jordan River, and went into the desert for 40 days, then he went back up north to his native area, to the area of the Sea of Galilee. So often, when I've been working on homilies and so on, reading the Gospels, I've wondered, what does the Sea of Galilee, how big is it really if you are there? And so I was very happy to find that out. You can very easily see across the Sea of Galilee. It's bigger than Lake Mendota, but it's not at all hard to see across it. You can, I think, just see north to south, the whole length of it, if it's a clear day. So it's a relatively small body of water.
The Sea of Galilee was one of my three favorite places, and the reason why is because when I was growing up, I used to go fishing with my grandfather all the time up in northern Wisconsin. And the Sea of Galilee looks like any lake in Wisconsin, Lake Mendota, Lake Monona. It's just so ordinary. And so once again, the whole idea of the God of the universe becoming one of us, the God of the universe entering into our world and doing what we do, spending time on boats, going fishing, walking along the shoreline, things of that nature. It just really kind of struck me like this is not just, once again, something that happened far, far, far away, but this is very common to our own experience. And so really, I just was really taken with the Sea of Galilee. So this kind of area right here, this is the northern shore. And back in the 1980s, they had some drought weather, and so the level of the lake began to decrease. And what they eventually discovered, kind of buried in some of the sand along the shoreline in a place like this, was what they called the Jesus boat. And this boat right here They've done dating on it, and it goes back to the time of Jesus and the apostles. They don't know for sure if Jesus and the apostles would have used it. It's probably not the case. But they've reconstructed it and kind of put it together, and it's in this museum that's right there. But it would have been the same sort of boat that Jesus and the apostles would have been on. And the thing that was very interesting that our tour guide said is that boats of this size typically would have held 13 people. Pretty interesting. 12 apostles plus Jesus, right? 13 people. And so it's just kind of another way that, you know, once again, God's providence, like things just kind of line up, things sort of make sense. And so it was fascinating to be able to see this 2,000-year-old boat that was in this museum right there. So now turning to Cana in Galilee.
So as you saw on that map, Cana was a little town not far from Nazareth. And this is the parish church of the Catholic community in Cana, where we joined the local people for a Sunday morning mass, the first Sunday that we were in the Holy Land. And it was very interesting, the Catholic mass celebrated in Arabic, because the Muslims conquered the Holy Land, and you have to speak the language of the people who run the place. And so the local language of the Catholic people is Arabic. Very, very hospitable people. You know, kind of a typical parish. Not everybody was there right on time. The children were sent up to sit around the altar at the front of the church. You know, very recognizable as the parish experience. And then, but this church is also built on top of something. It's built on top of what seemed to be large public halls, which, you know, like banquet centers today, would be places that people rented to have weddings. And preserved there is this stone jar, which would be like those described in the Gospel of John, where the Lord ordered the stewards to fill these stone jars with water, and then they took out some to the head waiter, and it had become wine. So that their parish church is built on top of the ruins of the place where that first of the Lord's miracles seems to have happened.
And I also love the fact that when we were at Mass here, first of all the couples also had a chance to renew their wedding vows. So all the couples we were with, I mean, it was a very touching thing for all of them to be able to go there and to do that. But one of my frustrations, and Monsignor's got a little bit better situation downtown, but sometimes I can be working with my altar servers, and they just look pretty, like, disengaged with the Mass. I can get a little frustrated. They show up with, like, bright neon green shoes, and, like, in the middle of Mass, I need the book, and I'm looking over at them, and they're just, like, looking at the ceiling. And I can be like, oh, it's just this American thing. But at the Mass there, the altar servers were the exact same way. They wore, like, you know, these bright shoes, and they were, like, looking around the whole time like they're not wanting to be there. And I was like, all right, this is a common human broken experience. Whether you're in Cana in the Holy Land or in rural Wisconsin, it's a universal human experience with 12 and 13-year-old boys. So now we're at Capernaum, which is at the northernmost part of the Sea of Galilee. And once again, I'll let Monsignor kind of take it from here, but very quickly, this was the place where the Lord really made his home base for the 3 years of his public ministry. And as you walk in, there's a sign here, the town of Jesus, but it's really the town of Peter. It's a town where Peter's mother-in-law lived. It's a place where Peter lived. And so as Jesus eventually calls Peter, it's a place where Jesus made his own, and where he would go kind of for like a couple days at a time, a couple weeks at a time for a mission, but eventually he'd always return back. And I'll let you keep talking from here.
So here's a little statue of Peter. As you can see, Capernaum is right on the Sea of Galilee. Peter and his brother Andrew and James and John were fishermen. So that was their profession. That's what they were doing before the Lord called them. And here, very, very interestingly, is a synagogue in Capernaum. You might remember that it was in the synagogue in Capernaum where the Lord was given the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. He opened it to the place where it said, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, therefore the Lord has anointed me to bring good tidings to the poor. The Lord announced the beginning of his mission in the synagogue at Capernaum. Now, this synagogue in ruins would not have existed at the time of Jesus, but again, it is built on the ruins of another synagogue that would have been the synagogue in the time of the Lord. So it was in that place that the Lord announced the beginning of his mission to the world.
And this is also the synagogue where Jesus would have engaged with the Jewish leaders in the bread of life discourse. So when Jesus says, "I am the bread of life, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life within you," all of John chapter 6, that would have taken place right in the synagogue here, which it's you can't really see it here, but really this is, it's 30, 50, 100 feet away from a church that we'll show you in a minute. But the church is built upon where Simon Peter lived and where the Lord lived. And so literally it'd be like walking across the street or whatever. And so when the Lord goes and he's engaging with the Jewish leaders, talking about how they must eat his flesh and drink his blood, and he kind of angers a lot of them, all of a sudden he has to go more or less just across the street, and that's kind of, you know, how to get away from them and everything. But it wasn't like he was traveling miles or doing all of this, so.
Yes, and this is a modern church, built in a very kind of an unusual way, on stilts almost. It looks a bit like an upside-down boat for the Sea of Galilee theme, but it is built over the excavations of the house and neighborhood where Simon Peter's house was. And as Father Scott said, just a street or two from the synagogue, closer to the synagogue than we are to St. Patrick's right now. This is the modern interior of that church. But again, you can see the opening, the glass in the middle there, looks down into the excavations from the first century. And there are some of those foundations where people who can look at these things and understand what they're seeing can tell where the rooms were, where the houses were, and so on.
So this is one of the meals we ate, those of us who were adventurous. Monsignor, I don't think you got one of these, so did you?
I don't remember.
You went for the ravioli or something like that. But in the Sea of Galilee, there's a famous fish that gets caught that is called the St. Peter's fish, just because most likely it's the type of fish that he would have caught, as well as the other apostles who were fishermen. And so you can get that for lunch. And they tell you you should eat the eyeballs because that's the most tasty part, but I had to draw a line somewhere. So I was like, you know, no eyeballs for me. Although the woman in our group who was from Madison, she did eat the eyeballs, and she said, you know, they're really overrated. So I was vindicated in my decision not to eat them. So now we're in Galilee still, once again, up in the north by the Sea of Galilee, and this is the Church of the Beatitudes. And this is the church that's built upon the place where the Lord gave the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. And so this is the exterior of the church. And then Monsignor had the great privilege of being the main celebrant. We celebrate Mass a lot of these places, but he had the great privilege of being the main celebrant on the inside. I don't know if you want to add anything about that.
As you see, it's a kind of a modern church, and it's built with seating all around the altar, kind of a hexagon or an octagon. But a beautiful spot, very rural even today, and kind of a gentle slope coming up from the Sea of Galilee, and as Father Scott said, it was the place of the Sermon on the Mount.
So then this, once again, still along the Sea of Galilee, this is the church that's built upon the site where there's a multiplication of the loaves and fishes, where the Lord fed the 5,000. The inside of the church, it was very kind of austere, as you can see. Once again, it was built, I think, in the early 1900s, upon the ruins, upon the ruins, upon the ruins, etc. The most memorable thing about it are two things. Is one right here, this is kind of the rock underneath the altar that they say the Lord would have sat upon as he did this teaching, or did the miracle, I'm sorry. And then the other memorable thing Monsignor reminded me of earlier is that it was the most expensive bathroom to use. They charge you the most money to use the bathroom there. So it's run by Germans, and that probably explains why. So then, now this is Mount Tabor. This is the site of the Transfiguration. And you can see how that mountain really, I mean, compared to the rest of the land around there, it really juts up. And so it would have been a little bit of an impressive hike up there, and then also obviously just an impressive visual from the top.
In the Gospels, you might remember, Peter makes the great confession of faith at Caesarea Philippi. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then the Gospel says, 6 days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John up the mountain and was transfigured before them. So Caesarea Philippi, we did not visit. That's not Caesarea Maritima on the water. Caesarea Philippi is north, quite a ways north from the Sea of Galilee. But I had wondered from time to time, why did the Lord wait 6 days after the confession of faith for the transfiguration? As our guide very helpfully pointed out, it's about a six-day walk from Caesarea Philippi to Mount Tabor. He did not wait. That was the amount of time it took. And it would not be a place that you would go for touristic reasons in the first century. You know, people were struggling to survive. It was a hard climb. Even today, the bus took us part of the way up, then we had to get onto the smaller, like 10-passenger buses to go the rest of the way to the top of this mountain. So the Lord was being very discreet. I'm sure there was no one anywhere near him when he showed those three chosen apostles that glimpse of his glory. But there at the top of the mountain is this very nice church, and of course very lovely views there from the top of Mount Tabor as well.
That's just the interior.
Yeah, just the interior of that church.
Okay, and then moving back to the south now, coming back closer to Jerusalem, this is Bethany, and this is, once again, the home of Lazarus and Martha and Mary. And this was the church that was built upon the site where Lazarus was raised from the dead. And I had the privilege of being the main celebrant at Mass here, but it was after a long day of being in a bus and coming all the way from Jordan back over there. We were trying to get there and celebrate Mass, but then we had to get to the hotel and have dinner. And so Monsignor told me he didn't even remember this church, which I kind of took a little personal since I was the main celebrant at that Mass. But we're working through our forgiveness issues here. Okay, so now coming to Jerusalem, obviously you've all seen pictures of it and very famous and everything. The Dome of the Rock, which is one of the great Muslim mosques of the world, is built upon the site where the temple once stood, the Temple Mount, where the great Jewish temple, the holy place for the Jewish people once resided. This dark covered dome here, this is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the church that, as you'll see in a few moments, is built upon the site where the Lord was crucified and then where he was buried. And so that's a great Christian holy site that we spent most of our time at in Jerusalem. The whole old city is surrounded by the old wall, and then the modern city is kind of built around the outside. There are, I can't remember, is it 6 or 7 gates around the outside. And so you have to kind of go through one of these gates, and once again, the whole idea is back in the ancient world, the way you would protect yourself is by having gates so that not everybody could just kind of descend upon the city. And the gates have been torn down, they've been rebuilt, they've been torn down. The Muslims eventually, when they overtook it a few hundred years ago, they actually blocked one of the gates because that's the gate that that people believe that God is going to return through at the end of time, and so they don't want the Christians and the Jewish people to be able to have that prophecy fulfilled, so they've actually blocked that gate so no one can actually cross through there anymore. So there's a lot of political stuff, obviously, when you have the three largest world religions all living in this very small area, and they all have great devotion to this area and a great historical interest in it, great religious interest. And once again, as I told you at the beginning, the city is divided into these four quarters as well. So it's a very fascinating city. It's a very, it's a place I really would love you to spend 6 months in and just like wander all the streets and talk to people there and things like that. Unfortunately, I just didn't have the time to do that this time. So outside of Jerusalem is the Church of Pater Noster, the Church of our Father, where the Lord taught his disciples how to pray. Lord, how should we pray? Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And so it's run by the French right now. Was it the French government who runs it? Or is it a French religious community? I can't remember. It's run by the French at the very least. But the fascinating thing is all these little signs right here that you see kind of along the side. In the entire church, they have 100 plus, 150 plus, but it's the Our Father in all the different languages of the world. And so you can walk around the entire church and see, you know, this very important prayer that the Lord taught his people, but in all the different tongues of the world. So that was very beautiful when we were there as well. Then we had the chance to go to the Israel Museum, which is in Jerusalem. And in the 1950s or the 1960s, there was a gentleman who made this huge, huge model of what Jerusalem would have looked like right after the time of Christ. And so it's just very fascinating because this gives us a glimpse a little bit. This would have been the Temple Mount, and this is the temple right here. And so it shows us a little bit. This is the place where Jesus would have made these journeys with his apostles for Passover and for the other holy days. And this was really the center of Jewish life. And so you can kind of see it a little bit better there. But once again, real quick, just going back, you can see, I mean, how small this guy is. I mean, this is a huge, huge, huge model. I mean, it's a good 5-minute walk all the way around it. So it's really fascinating, though, to be able to get a glimpse of what the city of Israel or the city of Jerusalem would have looked like shortly after the time of Christ.
So just before the Lord's Passion, the Gospels tell us he wept over Jerusalem. And so this is a church called Dominus Flavit. Jesus wept. It looks a bit like a teardrop or an upside-down teardrop. And through that window on the right side there, you look out toward the Dome of the Rock and the city of Jerusalem.
And so once again, in Jesus' day, you would have looked out and seen the temple. So when Jesus was up there and he would have mourned over Jerusalem, knowing what's coming, knowing that they're going to be the city that he is crucified in, he weeps over them as he's looking at this place that was the center of their religious life, which is just, it's once again, very moving, very, just very interesting historically as well.
We're trying to make you stand and sit up.
Yeah, and this is the great privileged place for Jewish people especially to pray the Western Wall. So this would be the retaining wall holding up the platform where the temple was built and where that mosque of the Dome of the Rock is now located. So it was not the wall of the temple itself, it's the retaining wall that holds up the foundation of the temple. And the custom is that people pray in front of that wall and have prayer intentions written on slips of paper that they put into the chinks between the rocks. Pope John Paul II did that when he visited Jerusalem. Other world leaders and notable people do that, as well as the devout believers of all kinds who come there to pray.
If I remember correctly, I think they were saying too, once again, because the temple's not there, for the Jewish people, this is the holiest place that they have. And this would be the section of the wall that was closest to where the Holy of Holies was that still remains. And so the Holy of Holies would have been the great place that, once again, the high priest would have been able to go into once a year. And so this is the closest that they can get to it. But once again, it's just simply the retaining wall, not even of the temple itself, just because it was torn down in the year 70 by the Romans. So this is in Jerusalem. This is where the Last Supper was, sort of. So the room where the Last Supper was, the room where Pentecost happened, we'll show you in a second. But you can't have Mass there. And so this is the closest to that where they could build a church that we could have Mass at. So it's kind of neighboring. I think it was maybe like a building away or something like that. It was as close as you can get to the site of the Last Supper to actually have Mass. And so we did have Mass, and there's this nice statue here. It's a little hard to see, but it's of the Last Supper. But it's a modern church, so nothing spectacular, but it's the closest that they can get to this room right here, which the room itself dates back to the time of the Crusaders. So the room doesn't go all the way back to the time of Jesus and the Apostles. It's not like this was the exact room that they were in. But they believe that it is built upon the site where the Last Supper and Pentecost were held. And in some sense, it's a similar type of room. I mean, it's a public space, almost like this, that you could rent for banquets or for these religious feasts. And so Jesus and his apostles, they were able to go and to get this room and to have the Last Supper together there. But the room doesn't exist anymore as is. So this is, I think, one of our favorite churches, but I'll let the good Monsignor talk about it.
So the last site was the site of the Last Supper, after which the Lord goes to the Garden of Gethsemane and undergoes the agony in the garden in consternation about all that he foresees happening the next day. So this church is opposite Jerusalem to the east in the Garden of Gethsemane, looking toward Jerusalem. And in this church is the rock on which the Lord is said to have experienced the agony in the garden. So the church is built around that rock. There in the mosaic and the apse above the altar is a picture of the Lord on the rock, and the rock is there directly in front of the altar. So that's an object of great devotion, always an object of devotion for us when we visit that church and have Mass there at that altar.
And I particularly found it very moving just because the reality is every single one of us suffer in our life. Every single one of us suffer. And probably many of you even tonight are suffering in various ways. To be here, it just made real to me the fact that, once again, the Lord understands everything that we experience, except, choosing sin. That's the only thing that's different between him and us. But he really was fully human, and he really did suffer. And to think about him sitting upon that rock, knowing what is coming, just a profound suffering of heart and spirit and soul. Thinking about the fact that he knew that as he's doing this, his apostles are falling asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane. His closest friends and people that he needs to depend upon are sort of abandoning him, if you will, and obviously they'll very much abandon him the next day. It just really, for me in particular, put it into perspective, God understands what I'm going through when life doesn't work out and when my heart feels like it's being broken and I cry out to him in prayer. Yes, he knows as God, but he also knows through his own experience being fully man. And he's with us. He hasn't abandoned us. He really is the God who has suffered, but he redeems suffering. So then this is the Garden of Gethsemane, which is right next to this Church of All Nations. And the reason they call it Church of All Nations is all the different nations of the world have helped to rebuild that church, or that modern church is built upon that site. But the Garden of Gethsemane is really interesting because our tour guide was telling us that they've done some DNA testing or something like that with some of these olive trees that are there, and there's one or two of them that date back all the way to the time of Christ, 2,000 years. And they refer to these olive trees as the silent witnesses, because they would have witnessed the Lord while he's on his way to his crucifixion the night before, witnessed his suffering, and just kind of sat there silently watching, so to speak. And I just thought that imagery is just really, really beautiful once again. So then, once again, in Jerusalem, this is the next church we visited, St. Peter in Gallicantu, and this is probably the place, I think both of us would say this is probably the most moving place we were at. Is that fair? Yeah, so I'll let Monsignor talk about this a little bit here.
Well, Gallicantu means the cock crowing, the rooster crowing. So the story is pretty well known that the Lord is taken into the house of Caiaphas on trial. Peter is in the court, and he outside in the courtyard is questioned by some of the people warming themselves there as whether he is one of the disciples of this man. Peter denies the Lord, and then the cock crows as Jesus had foretold. So that church is built on the site of Peter's denial. But then in the house of Caiaphas, one can visit the dungeon that existed there, in which the prisoners, like the Lord himself, would have been kept awaiting the they're being handed over to the Romans. So I spoke about this in the Good Friday homily this past year, that you can see here where there was an opening for people to be lowered down into the dungeon from which there was no easy escape. And that is the floor and some of the walls of that dungeon space with a little lectern added there in later years. But to be in that dungeon, you can now, they've excavated a way to get down there so you can stand there in the bottom of it. But it's very moving because it would be completely unchanged from the time of Jesus. Those were the walls, that was the floor that he saw the night before he died. That's where he was sort of abandoned and alone. So to be in that place was a very special and moving experience.
And I'll be quite honest, even having been in seminary the entire time, it never really dawned on me, like, what happened to Jesus Thursday night? We know that he's arrested in the garden. We know on Good Friday he's crucified, but I never really thought, like, what happened, and not that he's spending, 9 hours sleeping there, but at least for a few hours he had to have been held somewhere. And so it would have been, once again, kind of lowered into this dark dungeon. Nobody who was close to him would have been able to visit him, to be with him, to comfort him. And once again, I think one of the great reflections is just, how often do we sort of feel stuck, like we're in a pit, like we can't get out of this routine or this rut, or there's some sort of brokenness in our life, and we just, oh God, take this away, I just wish I could get out of this. And once again, Jesus just completely understands that. I mean, he was stuck physically in this dungeon the night before he's about to be executed. And when we were down there on this lectern, they actually had us read Psalm 88. And if you've ever read Psalm 88, it's a beautiful psalm. And the thing I love about that psalm is that there's no easy, trite resolution at the end. Sometimes the psalms will say, God, I'm really, really suffering, but you are good and everything's going to work out. Psalm 88 just kind of talks about, Lord, I'm suffering, this is really hard, and my best friend is darkness. And it just ends like that. And you can't help but think, like, the Lord, having known these psalms, in a very real sense, that would have been the cry of his soul. Like, I'm just stuck in this pit. Everyone has abandoned me. I'm about to be crucified. I've come to, show the world my love. I've come to reveal the love of the Father. And this is how it's playing out. Just super, super powerful. Then right outside of St. Peter and Gallicanti, the church, there's this stairwell here. And this is a stairwell that goes back to the time of Christ. And he would have walked kind of up as he's being led from the Garden of Gethsemane up to Caiaphas' palace where he was put into the prison. And then eventually he probably would have walked back down there on his way to Calvary. And so once again, excavations have revealed that goes back to the time of Christ, so he would have probably walked on some of those stones. So I tried my best to kind of lean over and see if I could find a loose piece or something like that to take as a souvenir. But continuing on, the Via Dolorosa, the Way of the Cross. Monsignor and I were talking about this earlier, and this is very interesting. He in particular, but even probably to a lesser degree, I thought, okay, some of these places we're not going to really know, if it was really where the Lord did this or where the Lord did that. But the Way of the Cross is going to be the one place that we'll kind of be able to do exactly what he did. But it's actually sort of the opposite. With all these other churches, once again, they're built upon previous churches. They're built upon previous churches. They're built upon places going all the way back to the time of St. Helena and before that, venerated by the successors of the apostles. But with the Way of the Cross, the Via Dolorosa, because the city of Jerusalem has changed so many times over the last 20 centuries, you can't actually walk on the same path that Jesus would have walked on his way to Calvary, just because there are now buildings there and they just don't even know some of where it is. So it's sort of, the best they do is to try to kind of take a modern take on it, and you still get the chance to pray at the Stations of the Cross, to reflect. They built little steps or stops along the way for you to kind of pause for each of the different 14 stations, but you also have to kind of psychologically know, like, this is not actually the path he took. It's impossible to kind of walk that. But what you see is, you kind of start in this area right here, And then some of them on the inside, they just have these beautiful, mosaics or paintings or sculptures and everything. Different places had different kind of artwork. Once again, kind of symbolizing the Lord's, the way of the cross, so to speak. Just some beautiful statues of the Lord, obviously, as he's on his way to Calvary. But then this was very fascinating. Once again, like I said, you're actually walking down these main streets. So we had a group of, is it like 50 or 55 people? I mean, a few dozen people. You saw the picture at the very beginning. We're walking down these streets of the ancient city, praying the Stations of the Cross. And meanwhile, people are shopping and they're selling, goods. This is actually a street. It looks like a back alley or something. It looks like, maybe like a really crowded flea market. But that's actually one of the streets in the old city. And so we're trying to walk down and pray. Meanwhile, other people are just shopping. It's just another day for them. And so it's kind of like this, once again, this weird kind of a mixture of every kind of culture and different religions and people who are not even interested in things and people who are just trying to survive and make a buck, all of that, all in one place. I really felt like in some ways the old city of Jerusalem was like being in New York City. You see kind of every type of walk of life, every type of person. Only probably even more so because all the major religions are well represented there. Where in New York, we tend to be a little bit more secular than the United States. So Jerusalem was just a very fascinating city, and the whole Via Dolorosa was very interesting. Do you have anything to add with that, or?
Just that we do know where Pilate's house was. As I said before, Pilate spent most of his time in Caesarea Maritima, lovely spot on the water. But he came into Jerusalem for the High Holy Days, because that's when there was the potential for trouble. So he was in Jerusalem at the time of Passover to keep an eye on things, keep things under control. So we know where his palace was. We know where the Way of the Cross started. We know where it ended, because the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is there, covering Calvary and the Lord's tomb. But as Father Scott said, the city has been destroyed and rebuilt a number of times, so the streets are not in the same place. And finally, here is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's funny, when we think of a church, we think of a kind of a designed building that has a very rational form and, transepts and symmetrical. And so, not so much the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's built to house these holy sites, and it isn't really a very coherent building. What that red light is indicating there is a ladder. And that ladder is always there because the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is divided into areas that are controlled by different churches. The Catholic Church controls certain parts, the Greeks control certain parts. The Ethiopians have a place on the roof. The Armenians have a certain part of the church. And everything is about the status quo. There was an agreement about who could do what, who could clean what, who could move what. And that, the legend is, that that ladder was there when the status quo was established. And so no one has the right to move that ladder. So it's a very, it's a delicate situation with many different competing groups. Right after we visited the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Israeli government announced a plan to begin taxing religious holdings in Jerusalem and in Israel. And that is one thing that got all of the Christians to unite. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was closed for about 5 days, right after we visited, in protest against this initiative of the Israeli government to tax it. And so the government relented.
Yeah, we actually really lucked out. Literally, had we shown up the next day, we would not have been able to get into this church. And I would have been like, we've gone all the way over to the Holy Land and we can't go see the holiest church in all of Christianity. So God was very good to us, and my heart all at the same time though broke for all those people who didn't have that experience. But so moving on, just to kind of help you visualize, once again, this is the church, and this church has been built upon two primary places, the place where the Lord was crucified, and then the place where he was buried. And so I just found a couple of images on the internet because I really wanted to be able to kind of visualize, like, how does this all fit together and everything? Because I had no understanding of this before we went. I had no idea that both of those places were in the same building. But literally they are, and I'll show you how that's the case. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was it was outside the city wall. So the old city of Jerusalem is still bigger today than it was at the time of Christ. Over the course of 20 centuries, it's expanded a little bit. So the city walls today are not identical with how they were at the time of Christ. So because of Jewish laws, you couldn't have people buried inside the city, so they had to be buried outside the city, they had to be executed outside the city. So you'll see right here, this would be where the city wall is, and then this was an old stone quarry here that had been dug out. At the top here, this is Calvary, this is where the Lord and the two criminals would have been crucified, and then just 140 feet, so once again, half of a football field, away is kind of a hole in the wall where they would have buried him. They would have put his body there to start to decompose and to decay, and that's where he would have been buried. And so it's not that far away. In my mind, I don't want to speak for you, Monsignor, but I always imagined it was, you know, a half mile away or something like that. I never understood that it's half of a football field away, so to speak. So then kind of going in a little bit more, once again, they would have, kind of the Jewish burial custom at the time of the Lord is to have had this chamber, once they would have wrapped up the body and put all the various anointings on and ointments and everything, they would have placed it in there, they would have rolled a stone in front of it to let it decompose for some time, and so this kind of once again shows what it would have looked like in that stone quarry. What they've now done inside the church, as you'll see, is they built this edicule, which is kind of this church or chapel within the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, to kind of encapsulate this place where the Lord was laid to rest. And so I'll show you kind of pictures, but you kind of would line up here, you're able to walk in, then there's a first chamber here, and then when you walk in there, then there's a second chamber, and it's on the shelf of the second chamber that is kind of, there's a marble casing on top upon the shelf where the Lord would have been crucified. There's also, buried, thank you. But that's also interesting that the Coptics, the Copts, they own this little chapel here, and you can actually see part of this chamber from their side, because once again, the church is kind of co-run by six different Christian groups. So this, once again, another visual that kind of helps explain it a little bit, but so, once again, this was where the crucifixion happened, and then 140 feet away, this is where the burial would be. And all this like orange area, this is all the rock that was excavated by St. Helena to allow this one church to be built, the two domes, one church to be built upon both sites here. So that kind of shows you how these two sacred sites are now kind of encapsulated in this one church, this one building. And then this just very quickly is a graphic that shows the different groups. So the Greeks own all the green. They're in control of all the green parts, so the Greek Orthodox. The Roman Catholics, the Latin Rite Catholics, we are in control of all the orange. The Armenians control all the yellow. The Syrians, the red, so just this little area here. The Copts, the brownish color, so they have that little part of the back part of the edicule. This is the edicule right here underneath one of the domes. And then some of the other brown area. And then there's some common areas as well. So that's where anybody can go at any time, and they're not going to fight over that. And then there's, just all the different rooms and everything. But so it just goes to show this one building is controlled by all these different groups. And so if they're going to do anything, they all have to kind of agree with it. If it's not like if it's in common area. So that's where that ladder was there when they signed this agreement, the status quo. And so no one's allowed to, the ladder's been there for like 150 years or 170 years. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? Or if there's like a candle or an oil lamp that needs to be replaced in common area, if they don't all agree, it can't get replaced. It has to just stay as it is, the status quo maintaining how it is. And so I had to laugh about it because my whole experience after being there was, well, if the Christians can't all cooperate and get along in the church where the Lord was crucified and where he was buried, I don't feel so bad that all the people in my pews and in my church can't get along either, right? I mean, the Lord can't do any better than I can do, right? So I kind of took some satisfaction with that. The Christians fight everywhere, unfortunately, and we have to kind of keep trying to overcome those differences. But so then, kind of coming in the inside here, I'll let Monsignor take this again.
So the this is two images. On the left, you see a stairway within the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that goes up to Calvary, to the high point.
So the stairwell is right here.
The stairwell is right there. And that orange is the chapel that's pictured on the right there. And that is our chapel, Catholic chapel, Latin chapel, where I had the great privilege of celebrating Mass. And then just next to it, there I am celebrating Mass, and some sisters there from Mother Teresa's order. And then just beyond is the Greek chapel. And it was over in that area where there is an opening in the floor where you can reach down and touch the stone hill of Calvary. So as Father Scott said, this was all part of an old quarry. What's called Calvary is really the highest point of that stone quarry. And then what was the Lord's tomb was one place where stone had been quarried out, leaving an opening. So it was all excavated so this church could be built all around and over those holy sites.
And so very quickly, it's very interesting. This chapel that Monsignor celebrated Mass, this is once again the Catholic chapel, but that's a place where the Lord was nailed to the cross, which is why they have him being nailed to the cross right here. And then once again, just literally 20 feet away over here is this chapel right here. And these rocks is the high point of Golgotha or Calvary, where the crosses, the crucifixes were kind of held in and where the Lord died. And that part is owned by the Greeks. So this is a picture then of the edicule that I had kind of shown you the diagram of that's built upon the place where the Lord's tomb was. I didn't take this photo, but it was better than the ones I did take. So this kind of shows it again. So then, okay, once again, you kind of have to line up and you're able to go in and they kind of rush you through again because there's so many people trying to do this. But so imagine you're kind of out here waiting in line. Eventually you get there and then you get into the first room. And this is the first room here. And in this little box here, there's a piece of stone, and they say that stone is part of the original rolling stone that would have been rolled in front to block the tomb so that people couldn't get in. That would have been guarded by the Roman guards and everything. So then kind of going through even further, this is that shelf. It's kind of a marble or stone that's been built upon the shelf that the Lord's body would have been laid after he was taken off of the cross. And so you're able to get in there, and you literally, I mean, what did we have? Maybe like 15 seconds apiece or something like that. So you say it really fast, Our Father, you touch it, you pray for a couple people, but then you have to kind of get out. It's just really small. I think you can only fit like four or five people in there at a time. And you got, you know, hundreds if not thousands every day trying to get in there. But the one thing you see is there's no body. The Lord is risen, right? The Lord is risen. So this is very fascinating. Right underneath the chapel, the Greek zone, where the crucifixion happened, this is called Adam's Chapel here. And I think it's more a pious legend than obviously historical fact, and I think it's important to make those distinctions. But, you know, kind of the pious legend says that this would have been kind of in the basement, kind of deeper in the rock, and this is where Adam would have been buried. And the symbolism behind it, though, is just simply that as the Lord Jesus is hanging upon the cross, shedding his blood is dripping down upon Adam and baptizing him. And then this little area right here, this rock, it's hard to see, but this rock is cracked. And once again, the legend says, and I don't think this is historically verifiable, but the legend, the pious legend says, that rock split when the earthquake happened, when the Lord was being crucified. And so once again, just kind of these legends and this piety that's kind of developed around things that are actually historical. But the whole goal of it, once again, is trying to kind of help people to know that our faith is real, our faith is meaningful. These things are all connected. These are the two domes at the top of the church. This is the one that is right above the edicule. You can see the top of it right there. And then this is above the Greek part of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And now the Lord has risen from the dead, so we have moved back to the north.
So there was an appearance of the risen Lord to his apostles on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, where he did not identify himself, but they recognized who he was. There was a catch of fish, and he had breakfast with them to show that he could eat in his risen body. And so this little church called the Primacy of Peter, it has within it a stone, you see the big rock formation there, which is said to be the rocks on which the Lord and his apostles ate the breakfast when he appeared to them after he rose from the dead.
And it's also the site where Jesus asked Peter three times, "Do you love me?" Undoing Peter's threefold denial. So it would have been, once again, kind of on the shores of the Sea of Galilee here. Jesus three times, "Peter, do you love me? Peter, do you love me? Peter, do you love me? Go and feed my sheep." And so that's why it's called the Church of St. Peter's Primacy. And so then finally, in Jerusalem, kind of higher up beyond the Church of All Nations, which was kind of the Garden of Gethsemane, higher up the hill is the Chapel of the Ascension. And this is the place where they believe the Lord Jesus ascended to heaven. It's currently controlled by the Muslims. So it's actually, at one time, I think it even may have been like used as a mosque temporarily. It's not actively right now. But you also can't have mass here or anything like that. It's more just kind of almost a museum type thing. But you're able to go in. And then this rock right here is kind of encased. And that rock, they believe, is kind of the rock that the Lord kind of would have been on right before he ascended. So it's kind of up outside of Jerusalem, kind of up on the hill. And then obviously kind of symbolically ascended even higher to the Father's right hand. This is very fun. We had the chance to go down to the Dead Sea area, and there was ice cream in the lowest place on earth, as the Dead Sea is the lowest place on earth. But the ice cream was not all it's cracked up to be, so I'd stick with the sassy cow in this area. And then this is just to show you that despite their struggles this year, there is hope, and people worldwide cheer for them. The Packer fans are everywhere, and they even have Green Bay Packers in Hebrew here. So I was very excited to find that in Jerusalem. So I think that's all we have for you this evening. So thank you for your attention. Thanks for looking at our vacation photos. All right, Mark, you're up.
Well, thank you, good fathers, for your being our pilgrimage guys this evening. Thanks for everything. Let's give them a hand.